Blog Talk Radio.
If you believe you can move the highest mountains, cross the greatest oceans, walk across the water, you feel defeated, falling on your knees and looking up for some hope tonight. You try to stand up, but you throw your hands up, like you no longer have the strength to fight. Cause you've seen too many sunsets, too many days ending in the darkest night. But on your own, you'll never know, you'll never know. If you believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the water, the water. Believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the water. If you believe.
They say that all you need is faith, but it's almost like you lost your way. Took a few wrong turns, took a few breaks, falling behind now looking for grace. Cause you need someone to lift you up, yeah, make right of the things you've done. Cause on your own you'll never know, you'll never know.
If you believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the water, the water. Believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the water. If you believe. If you believe.
You can do anything. You can do anything. You can do anything.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Ask Sophia. Good afternoon, America. It's in the afternoon. Everywhere else, it's in the evening. So without further ado, let's give a round of applause for the woman herself, Sophia.
Good afternoon to you all, and welcome to the Ask Sophia show here on G Radio, New York City. I'm your host, Sophia Giorgio, and on today's show, Mental Health Matters. It's a two-hour radio show dedicated to exploring the crucial topic of mental health and well-being. I have a very, very special guest, Monica Shafak, who is the CEO of the Kaleidoscope Plus Group charity based in the United Kingdom. And today, we're going to look at the impact of mental health on individuals, families, and society as a whole. We'll be discussing various aspects of mental health, including its importance, challenges faced, available resources and strategies for cultivating well-being. And our aim tonight is to promote as much awareness and understanding and support for mental health. So without ado, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Monica Shafak, the visionary CEO of Kaleidoscope Charity. She's a dynamic leader in the UK's mental health charity sector. She's dedicated to improving well-being and shattering stigmas. With her strategic initiatives, Monica has transformed countless lives and raised awareness across the nation. Monica, welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, thank you for the warm welcome. How fantastic was that introduction? Thank you so much for inviting me today. Absolutely brilliant to be here.
It's a pleasure, Monica, an absolute pleasure to have you here. And thank you for agreeing to come on the show to discuss this very, very important topic. So again, without any ado, please, Monica, tell our listeners who you are and a little bit of information on yourself, if that's okay.
Of course. So obviously, as you've said, my name is Monica Shafak. I have been involved with the charity sector for a number of years, and I've been the chief executive of the Kaleidoscope Plus Group since 2010. As you can imagine, given that I've been working with the charitable sector in mental health for that period of time, I have a huge passion for mental health, but I like to do things differently because I understand that not one size fits all. What works for one person may not work for somebody else. So I do like to do things a little bit differently to what your traditional, I guess, CEO would be doing. It's under my leadership that the charity rebranded from a local organisation into one that's now known as a national organisation in the UK, and we deliver services to tens of thousands of people every year. It's also during my tenure that the organisation became a top 100 company to work for and has been recognised as one as such since 2015 every single year, which is something I'm really, really proud of. And as
that's
well as
phenomenal.
Mental health, I have a huge passion for equality and diversity, and in particular creating pathways for women and women of colour within leadership roles. I've got a keen interest in football. I hold a number of executive roles in the football sector, including at Birmingham County Football Association, and I'm also the vice chair of the English Football Association's Asian Women's Inclusion Advisory Board and a member of the Premier League's Equality and Diversity Panel. So as you can imagine, I hold a number of hats, both in mental health and within football. And in February 21, I was actually appointed as the first woman and the first woman of colour to the Professional Footballers Association charity, which was a historic moment for that charity itself, but also a historic moment for women generally. I am a top 50 under 50 entrepreneurs on the 2020 list. I've won the behind the scenes list award on the Asian sports list, and I've also the winner of the achievement of award in the British Muslim Award. So yeah, that's me.
My goodness, what accolades, Monica. It's just so impressive. I mean, just for the listeners to know, I've known Monica for a number of years, and you've probably heard me on this show talk about the Kaleidoscope Group. They are my charity of choice. Mental health is a huge platform that I really want to sort of shine a light on. And Monica is the person that I have looked up to for many, many years. Oh. And she's a huge inspiration to women and individuals here in the UK, but, you know, has a reach, you know, nationally and potentially internationally too. So, I mean, I'm just delighted, like I said, to have you on the show, Monica. And I'm literally going to kick it off pretty quickly, actually, because I really want to delve really deeply into understanding mental health and well-being. So, you know, you are the perfect person to be able to shine a light on that for us. So let me just ask you, what is mental health and why is it essential for the overall well-being, all of our well-being?
So I guess mental health, it refers to our emotional, our psychological and our social well-being. I suppose the best way to describe it is that it includes how we think, how we feel, how we act and how we might handle stress or relate to others. But it also impacts on the way that we make choices. So obviously, given that it has that impact, it's crucial for our overall well-being because it influences pretty much every aspect of our lives. So if we have good mental health, it allows us to experience positive emotions. It allows us to enjoy things like happiness, joy and contentment. And it helps us to cope with different and difficult emotions like sadness, anger or grief, but allows us to do it in a healthy and constructive way. It also influences our ability to concentrate, to learn and to be productive. And when we have good mental health, we're more likely to achieve our goals, we're more likely to handle challenges effectively and perform better in various areas of life. So it can affect our school life, it can affect our work, and as I say, it also affects our relationships. So it pretty much significantly impacts the whole quality of our life. And if it's neglected, it will lead to mental illness.
Wow. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's so important, like I said, for everybody to understand, you know, what, you know, how important our mental well-being is. But I mean, can you explain what the difference is? Because I think there's a stigma of what we should call things. So, I mean, is it possible you could explain what the difference between mental health and mental illness is, Monica?
There is usually a lot of confusion with the two terms, and I'm glad you've asked that question, because without knowing, kind of like understanding the differences between the two, it can lead to further stigma. So as I said, mental health is something that we all have. We all have mental health in the same way as we all have physical health. Sometimes our physical health is okay, sometimes it's not okay. Sometimes our mental health is okay, sometimes it's not okay. And when it's not okay, that's when it becomes a mental illness. So they are related, but they are two different distinct concepts. So as I said earlier, mental health, that refers to how we behave. It refers to how we deal with certain situations. But mental illness kicks in when our mental health deteriorates. It refers to specific conditions that affect the way that perhaps we think. It affects our emotions. It affects our behavior and our overall functioning. It's a diagnosable medical condition that often requires professional assessment and treatment. And it can disrupt, you know, if it's left undiagnosed or left untreated, it can disrupt our personal thoughts, our feelings, our perceptions, that can lead to distress and lead to difficulties in daily life.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Monica, because I think a lot of us, I think every person potentially listening to the show today, we've all sort of experienced difficult times, you know, stressful times. And mental health can be affected through anything, through work, through personal issues, etc. So it's, I'm glad you've cleared that, because I think there's, like I said, there's always a stigma against, you know, what that means, mental health, mental illness. You don't know what to say sometimes, and I think that's really clear for people to understand. So, and talking, obviously, because we have listeners from all over the world that actually join and listen to this show, I try, I'd like to try and sort of cover lots of different statistics, and one of the statistics which I'm going to bring up now, and then obviously we'll move on, but according to the World Health Organization, apparently around one in four people globally experience mental health problems at some point in their lives, which I actually found, when you imagine how many people we have on the globe, it's just a phenomenal amount of people that, you know, experience the mental health problems, and I found it really shocking when I actually researched and got that information. I mean, how prevalent do, you know, are mental health issues worldwide, in your opinion? And have these, do you know whether these numbers have changed over time at all?
I would agree with that statistic. I do believe that one in four people will experience some form of mental health problem during their lifetime. It's interesting to hear, you know, you found that statistic quite alarming, but I think that's also partly because there is a lack of understanding in terms of what a mental health illness might be. So a lot of the time when people talk about mental health, they'll think of the kind of high level needs around kind of schizophrenia, psychosis, perhaps bipolar, but actually things like depression, anxiety, low mood are also mental health illnesses. And as you say, I can't imagine anybody on this globe who has not at some point in their life being anxious about something, or been stressing about something, or experienced low mood. So that statistic actually is pretty spot on, I would say, in terms of the number that experience mental health illnesses. But I'd also say that in terms of the prevalence, I guess that it varies across countries, because it does depend on things like cultural, social and economical differences as well, and access to healthcare. So there may be communities where access to healthcare is a lot harder than it is for others, or there may be countries where access to mental health healthcare is harder or not as, I guess, advanced. So these kind of issues will will change the prevalence across the globe as well. I think over the past few decades, there's probably been a notable increase in the reported prevalence of mental health issues, and I think that's because there has been a lot of improved recognition of what mental health is. There's been better diagnostic tools and methods. There's been increased awareness, and there have been changes to social and environmental factors. So on the one hand, the increase in mental health conditions may simply be because we're talking about it more and people are recognising it more, and therefore more and more people are coming forward and getting diagnosed, whereas in the past perhaps we weren't talking about this issue as much and people were being left undiagnosed. So I think it's a combination of a couple of things, really. It's obviously had significant attention on the global agenda in recent years as well. There's been a lot of efforts to reduce stigma. There's been campaigns to increase awareness, and there's been more technological approaches in actual service deliveries as well. But if you think about it, Sophia, the COVID-19 pandemic, that's had a profound impact on people's mental health. You know, the stresses that have led from that pandemic, the social isolation that people were going through, the economic uncertainties, the fear of the virus itself, that's all contributed to increased rates of mental health across the globe. And it's included, you know, increased levels of anxiety and depression and post-traumatic stress disorder as well. If you think about our frontline health professionals, they were kind of in autopilot during the pandemic. They were just dealing with the situation and trying to keep people as well as possible. But actually, now that we've come out of the pandemic, it's kind of like they've had time to slow down and think back on the last few years and think, oh my goodness, has that actually happened? What have we actually gone through? And it's at this time now that I feel that our healthcare professionals are actually experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder as a result, because they've actually slowed down and been able to understand the impact of everything that they've just been through.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've hit the nail again on the head. I think the pandemic has caused such a major issue, Monica. I mean, I think, you know, everybody that I'm in contact with and people that I know, you know, there's been times that we've all had to help and support each other, you know, through difficult times. I mean, how many times, Monica, obviously, I also want to tell people that, you know, we've been friends for a number of years. And I think as, you know, as friends, I think we've all always supported each other in lots of different things. And you are absolutely amazing in doing that. And I think people did reach out, but I think because we were all locked at home, people realised that help was still potentially out there. Because I think, please correct me if I'm wrong, can I just ask this? This is a slightly different question, but Kaleidoscope was still doing all the amazing work that they were doing, even through the pandemic, were they not? You know,
absolutely,
through Zooms and things like that.
Yes, we were. And we found that as a result of having to move a lot of our service, well, in fact, all of our services online, we didn't have a choice. We were actually able to reach more people. So if I give you an example of our counselling service, we provided counselling to a specific area within the UK. But once we moved to online through the need of having to change things during the pandemic, actually we started to see people across the country and internationally. And we found that since that point, people are actually more willing to receive services online because it's at a time and in a place that is more convenient to them. So it actually has reduced the barrier, because some of the barriers can be people can't get out of the home because of social anxiety, so they can't actually go out to a centre to receive support. Or they may be at work, and actually a lot of the services are delivered during working hours. So by the time they finish work, actually there's no services left or open for them to receive services from. So by being able to do it online, actually that's opened up the doors for very many people who perhaps didn't seek support before because they just could not access services. And another thing that we've found since the pandemic as well is that whilst people were at home and socially isolated, either on their own or, let's not forget, in relationships or in family units where they probably may not have wanted to be, you know, some people were in abusive relationships. Some people were finding that, actually, I can't spend 24/7 with this person. I don't want to be with this person anymore. It opened a whole range of emotions. It wasn't just the isolation that was causing some of the mental illness that that came as a result of the pandemic. People were actually reflecting on their lives and thinking, do I really want to do this for the rest of my life? Life's too short. You know, people experience deaths of, you know, loved ones and family members, and it really brought home the kind of the vulnerability of life, and people started to question, do I want to be in this relationship? Do I want to be in this place of work? You know, what do I actually want to do with my life? So there were some really big decisions that people were having to make, and those big decisions can be, you know, can lead to triggers for mental illness conditions as well. So there's a whole raft of issues that have come out of the pandemic that we now are seeing. And I think we will continue to see that for the next 2-3 years at least.
Right, okay. Yeah, and I think I would tend to agree with you, because I think people are still, you know, one thing I've got to say, and I'm only talking from my own opinion here, is that I think people are starting to, Monica, and correct me if I am wrong, they're starting to open up a lot more than what they used to, because there was talked about this stigma. You know, people were concerned about, you know, saying that they had, you know, stresses or anything, because they were scared of what they would be, you know, labeled as potentially. But I think nowadays, because of the amount of publicity, if we're going to call it publicity, or, you know, we're talking about mental health constantly, you know, shows like this and other podcasts and things that people are doing and on TV, etc., has opened the doors to people understanding mental health better. I think that's really, really important to sort of say. Now, before we go forward, I just want to say that the phone lines are actually open. So if anybody actually does want to call in or has a question that they would like to ask me or Monica, obviously, on the subject, please feel free to call. The telephone number here is, if you're outside of the US, it's 001-563-999-3555. That's 001-563-999-3555. And the chat room is also open. So please, please feel free to call in or to send any questions through, and we'll try and answer those for you. Now, again, so moving on, I mean, mental health issues, I mean, they affect people daily. But how do mental health issues affect individuals' daily lives, Monica, and their overall functioning? How does that sort of work, do you think?
I think it's different things for different people. Like I said earlier, not one size fits all. And I think that's not just in terms of the way people receive support, but it's also in terms of how mental illness can affect individuals. So, I mean, broadly speaking, people who may experience mental health illness, it can lead to, I guess, emotional distress. They may experience persistent feelings of sadness, anxiety, feelings of irritability or emptiness, and it can cause intense mood swings that affect their ability to regulate their emotions effectively. It can have an impact on their concentration levels, on their memory, on how they make decisions, and they can find it really difficult at times to focus or to retain information. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, if you've got all of that going on, that's going to hinder your performance at work or at school, and it's going to affect the way that you actually are able to carry out daily tasks. I think the other important thing is that a lot of the time people who have a mental health illness, it can cause strain on relationships with family and friends and colleagues. They can have difficulty with maintaining healthy connections because of the fact that, you know, there's changes to mood. They can become socially withdrawn, or there can be other interpersonal challenges. And they can start to feel isolated, which can contribute to the mental health deteriorating as a result. I've mentioned earlier again that I guess there can be a huge impact on academic performance. But also, if you think about the workplace, individuals can find it difficult to meet deadlines. They can find it difficult to concentrate on tasks or have a consistent attendance record, whether that be at school or whether that be in the workplace. And obviously, while all of this is going on, that's decreased productivity for the individual. But it's also, if in the workplace, if you think about it, decreased productivity overall for that business as well, which is why it's really, really important that businesses look after the health and well-being of their employees. But there's also physical health outcomes as a result of mental illness, because you can't have good mental health without good physical health, and you can't have good physical health without good mental health. There's a knock-on effect on the two. And you might find that, you know, there are physical symptoms like headaches, sleep disturbances. People can feel really fatigued. They can have digestive issues. And over time, physical health can deteriorate as a result of mental health not being diagnosed or not being maintained. I guess as well, there are lots of examples of perhaps people with mental health issues who've engaged in risky behaviours as a way of coping and as a way of alleviating some of those symptoms. So people can engage in things like substance abuse and self-harm and engaging in general, you know, dangerous activities. So it has a huge impact on our daily lives.
Okay. Now, can I just, for all you listeners out there, we're having quite a few calls come through, but unfortunately, we can't get to hear you. Can everybody, if you're calling in, please make sure that your radio is not playing in the background, because there's feedback, so we can't actually hear you. So please feel free to call back in. We did have some callers, Monica, and I just need to let everybody know. So if you're going to call in, please make sure that your radio is turned down so that we can actually hear you. And then obviously my producer can actually put you through into the show. So anyway, moving on. So, I mean, some of the stigmas that we were talking about, Monica, and we're going to go to a break soon, but I want to see if we can cover this question before we do that. What are the stigmas that are associated with mental health, you know, and how do they, you know, how do they hinder person, you know, to seek help? You know, what's your opinion on that?
I think personally, the stigma associated with mental health is probably one of the biggest barriers that stops people from seeking support. And I think that stigma often stems from a lack of understanding and misinformation about what mental health actually is. So the fact that you're doing this show today, Sophia, is so important to get people to talk about mental health and mental illness so we can dissociate the stigma that surrounds it and educate people on these issues, because it can lead to stereotypes, it can lead to misconceptions that portray, I guess, individuals with mental health issues as dangerous or as weak or as individuals who can be unpredictable. If you think about the media, if you think about perhaps not documentaries, but I guess shows and films where you have somebody with mental health illness, they're often portrayed as being dangerous. They're often portrayed as being very unpredictable approach. But actually, that isn't necessarily the case. And kind of stigma creates a fear of judgment. So if you're an individual who does need support, you know, because of that stigma, you feel like you're going to be judged. You feel like perhaps people will reject you. You feel like, you know, you're going to be discriminated against. And there'll be worries about being labelled, being treated differently, or facing negative consequences in either your personal relationships because people think you're weak, or by your employer who may think, well, this individual has a mental illness and therefore they can't work properly for us. So there's all sorts of things that are causing that barrier when it comes to stigma. But I think one of the other important things to note as well is that sometimes when you have a mental health illness and you focus on that stigma, actually you can start to internalize it and you can start to blame yourself. And that can, you know, that can lead to feelings of shame. It can lead to feelings of guilt. You blame yourself for those mental health challenges and you start to feel embarrassed or feel inadequate. So if you've got those feelings, naturally you're going to be reluctant then to seek support and get that support that actually you deserve. You deserve to have support for your mental health in the same way as you deserve to have support for any physical condition. And just like there is no stigma associated with going to your GP or your practitioner for a physical health condition, there should absolutely not be any stigma to go and get support for your mental health. As I said earlier, you cannot have good mental health if you don't have good physical health. You can't have good physical health if you don't have good mental health. The two are intrinsically linked. So it's really, really important that we destigmatize mental illness and we ensure that that stigma doesn't dismiss mental health symptoms, because sometimes individuals who need that support think, well, because I'm going to be judged or because people think I'm weak, actually I shouldn't be seeking this support and I'll be all right. So I think it's really, really important that we do try and destigmatize as much as we can.
Absolutely, Monica. And I think, you know, by doing these type of shows and people listening to this show tonight, I'm hoping that it opens doors for people to think, yeah, you know, if they are suffering, that they don't have to suffer alone, that they can actually get the help that they need through, you know, local charities in any country. I mean, there are mental health charities all over the world. Obviously, you are here from the UK with me. However, you know, I know that the United States has suffered, you know, extremely badly with mental health, and you know, domestic violence has increased, you know, substantially since the pandemic, and you know, through a lot of the research that we've been doing. And I know, again, I'm quite keen on statistics, and I know that in the United States, from a financial perspective, mental illness is estimated to have cost approximately $193 billion in lost earnings per year from people suffering from mental, you know, suffering with their mental health. So, you know, it's really important that we sort of get that message out to everybody. And what you're doing today, Monica, thank you so much, is opening, you know, people's imaginations to, you know, understanding what, you know, what help is there and what they should be doing and attributing, you know, their feelings to. So that's really great. We're going to go to a short break in a couple of minutes, Monica, but just to ask, I mean, with the stigmas that obviously that are associated, what do you think is the most common stigma? Would you have anything in particular that you would you'd actually sort of pinpoint or not?
I think my personal view is one of the most common stigmas associated with mental illness is that the person who is feeling the mental distress often end up feeling like they are weak because they shouldn't be feeling a certain way. Well, actually, it's quite common to have a mental health concern because of the challenges that everybody faces in life. And I think it's really important that we get across the point that seeking support is actually a form of strength. It's not a form of weakness. Looking after yourself is something that is really, really important, and you are very strong actually trying to seek that support. Taking that first step is going to be one of the hardest things that an individual will do, but it is the most important thing. And from that step onwards, with the right support, the right guidance, actually you are well on your way to recovery. And if you have a condition that actually you can't recover on, you are well on the way of being able to manage that diagnosis, being able to manage that illness so that you can continue to live a healthy and fulfilling life, because that's what everybody deserves. And just because you've got a mental health illness does not mean that you cannot do that. It's so important to understand that. We are so much more than our mental health. There are so many different things to our personalities than our mental illness. So if there's one thing that I want everybody to understand, that would be it.
Right. But on that note, we're going to go to a very quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. Attention jet setters and high flyers. Are you tired of settling for ordinary flights? It's time to elevate your travel experience with GrexJet, the ultimate luxury jet service. Our cutting-edge fleet features the finest aircraft. With GrexJet, you'll soar through the skies in the epitome of luxury and sophistication. Wherever you want to go, GrexJet will take you there, from bustling cities of the United States to the exotic destinations worldwide. Our flights will transport you seamlessly to your desired location. So why settle for ordinary when you can experience extraordinary? Step into a world of luxury and book your next journey with GrexJet today. Call us now on 212-951-1324 or visit our website at www.grexjet.net. GrexJet, redefining luxury air travel, one flight at a time. Right.
I've been trying to get to you for a long time. Your constant beep has been on my mind. I was thinking about a shortcut I could take. I got caught in the rush hour. Fella started to shower. You with love and affection. Now you won't look in my direction. On the expressway to your heart. That expressway, not the best way. At 5 o'clock, it's much too crowded. No, it's much too crowded. So crowded. Caught in the rush hour. Fella started to shower. You with love and affection. Won't you look in my direction? On the expressway to your heart. That expressway, not the best way. At 5 o'clock, it's much too crowded. You know it's much too crowded. So walk out. I got caught in the rush hour. This fella started to shower. You with love and affection. Come on, look in my direction. On the expressway to your heart. That expressway, not the best way. At 5 o'clock, it's much too crowded. Much too crowded. So crowded.
Got it, baby.
everybody. You're listening to Sophia on the Ask Sophia Show, and I have a wonderful guest on this evening, Monica Shafaki, who is the CEO of the Kaleidoscope charity here in the UK, and we are talking mental health. Welcome back, Monica.
Thank you.
Just moving on, just thinking, whilst we were listening to the music, I was just thinking about some of the things that you were saying, and it's so prevalent that we have to really do all we can to help support charities like yourself, you know, in, because I just want to double check, but you don't get much funding, do you, generally? You don't get much funding from governments and things like that to help with the mental health aspects, funding for the charities. You don't do that, do you?
Unfortunately, funding for mental health services within the UK has decreased year on year. Whilst it's something that actually is high on the agenda, the political agenda and the business agenda, it's probably the poorer relation when it comes to funding. It's one of the services that ends up being cut. So whilst demand is increasing, public sector and government funding for mental health services has actually been decreasing, which makes it really difficult for charities like ours to be able to offer that support. And as you can imagine, it can be really difficult when you have somebody approach you to say that, you know, they have a mental health difficulty and they are seeking your support, for you then to have to say, well, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to wait 6 months or 9 months, because at this moment in time, you're on a waiting list of many, many other people, and it shouldn't be like that. So, yeah, unfortunately, that is the case with not just our charity in the UK, but lots of mental health charities.
Of course. Now, we've had a question come through, Monica, and it's something for us to look at. But one of the questions that we've had through from one of our listeners, it says, what about the people of colour who have historically didn't talk about mental health? How can one overcome, how can they actually overcome that? Is that an area that you've ever had to deal with in the charity?
It's an area that I often have to deal with. I'm a person of colour myself, and I often talk about mental health within my own community, which can be frowned upon. I think we spoke about earlier the fact that there's a lack of understanding of mental health, and that's generally across the board. But when we look at certain cultures, there can be a greater lack of understanding, and sometimes it can be associated with other things. It can be associated in some cultures, not all, with things like black magic. It can be associated with bringing shame on the family, shame on the individual. There can be some cultures where it's very much about, you know, just let's push it under the carpet, pretend it's not happening, and, you know, don't hang out your dirty laundry, as people might say. So I think as with all communities and as with all cultures, it's a case of us making that collective decision to actually talk about this issue openly and normalise the conversation of mental health, because the more normalised it, people start talking about it. But I guess on the other side of that as well is, you can't be something that you can't see. Representation is key. Representation matters. And I think with mental health services, it's really important to understand the cultural background of an individual and perhaps the challenges of being within a certain community, what that might bring to that individual. Because without building that connection and fully understanding the individual from the individual's point of view, you can't provide an effective service. So we need to have people of colour providing services. We need to have people of colour making decisions about services. We need to have people of colour and other communities. So, you know, people like the LGBT community, for example, they're facing similar disadvantages. They all need to be involved collectively in both service delivery, in designing services, in, you know, making decisions about services, but also delivering them. So I think it's a huge subject in itself.
Yeah. One of the things that another question that we've had just come through as well, Monica, they're asking, the question is suicide. it's quite a large area when mental health is involved. Children, one of the things that we need to talk about is the amount of children that have been affected, and this is a question that has come through. You know, how can parents deal with situations with their children if they're struggling with mental health? Do you have a, you know, let's say, for example, in the charity, do you have a department that potentially, you know, counsellors that can help children? And I know what I'm really proud about, Kaleidoscope, you do actually have a suicide line, do you not, that is funded through donations as well?
That's correct. So we do have a crisis support line. It's on a text-based service, so you don't actually speak to somebody, you text somebody, and a trained volunteer will text you back. And the reason why we have a text service, and it's linked into your earlier comment about children and young people, is because actually if you think about mobile phones nowadays, I don't use my mobile phone to make calls. I use it for messaging. And if you think about our children and young people, they don't talk to people on the phone anymore. It's all social media. It's WhatsApp. You know, it's Messenger. So people communicate by text. Our younger generation communicate by text. And it reduces one of those barriers that people may face when they have a mental health issue, that actually if I speak to somebody, they might speak to me, they, you know, they might respond to me in a certain tone of voice, which means they're judging me, or they might look at me in a certain way, which means they're judging me, or they're thinking of me in a certain way. So if you've got the text service, actually you don't see a person and you don't hear that person's voice. So those barriers, and it is about creating different ways and different opportunities for people to seek support. And you know, you can text a person. Our particular service is open 24/7. So, you know, it could be 3 o'clock in the morning. You could be anywhere. It doesn't matter. You can use that text service as soon as you need it. And I think those kind of things are really, really important. In terms of suicide, sadly, somebody dies by suicide every 40 seconds across the globe.
Oh, my God.
So
really?
By the time we have finished this show, 2 hours, my math is rubbish, Sophie. You should know that about me. But can you imagine how many people will have lost their life to suicide?
Wow.
And over 90%.
You know what? That is one very powerful statistic. Do you know, Monica, I had no idea that was the case. And, you know, that's actually shocking.
It's heartbreaking.
Every
40 seconds, somebody across the globe dies by suicide. And for each suicide, there are on average 150 other people who are affected. That will be friends, family, colleagues, emergency services, depending on how the suicide was completed and where it was completed, public who may have been around. And again, statistically, I mean, I think we need to be really clear that, you know, some of this information can be triggering. So, you know, we need to be mindful for our listeners. But for every suicide, 150 people on average are affected. And if you have been bereaved by suicide, you're actually twice as likely to be at risk yourself. So
wow.
It isn't a subject that we can ignore. Over 90% of people who die by suicide have a mental health condition. That's
My
just in
goodness.
The UK. I need to point that out. That's a UK statistic. And in the UK, 79% of those individuals did not seek support for their mental health condition.
Yeah.
And that's because of things like access to support, stigma, whether they can afford the support, whether it's the right kind of support, a whole range of issues.
Wow. And I think, you know, going back to where one of the things that I find very sad to a certain extent, and what you touched on, Monica, with teens or children about texting and social media and everything else that they're involved with. We all are. We all have, you know, the majority of people have social media, etc. However, I think one of the things that we've actually lost and what we have to try and encourage our kids to do is actually, and adults, is actually to start talking to each other again.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, we've lost that communication with a lot of people. I think us as old school, Monica, we still do all of that. We, you know, we still call people and we'll have a conversation on the phone. But I know from my own children, and, you know, I've got teenagers, as you have, Monica, but the thing is, they're constantly on the phone, and they're either on WhatsApp groups or they're, you know, they're not talking to one another, you know, having proper conversations. And I think we need to encourage, you know, people generally to start talking to each other again. But, and I don't know what your thoughts on that are, but that's my own personal opinion, I have to say. I just think, you know, we're getting so involved in the technological world now that, you know, we're forgetting what we need as humans. And as humans, we need to interact with other humans, you know, speaking, laughing, you know, having fun and all of this, but not just doing it over text, etc. Because I think, again, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, Monica, but I think, you know, the introduction of AI and lots of, you know, these technological sort of advancements, kids and adults don't need to talk to each other on a lot of things now. And I think that is where it's actually quite scary. I mean, and what are your thoughts on that?
I couldn't agree with you more, Sophia. And sadly, I think we have to accept that actually that's the way of the world. That's the way things are going. And as our kids, our teenagers are growing older, it is becoming a more technological world. As you say, AI has been introduced into everything. I mean, kids nowadays don't even have to write their essays. You know,
exactly.
You can go online,
yeah,
and it can all be done for you. Absolutely. It is worrying because they have lost those social skills. I think the pandemic didn't help because, you know, again, there was social isolation and people actually couldn't communicate other than through social media and technology of that nature. But we are moving into a world now where everything's online. Even dating, if you think about it, you know, when we were younger, we met our partners, you know, socially. We were out and about and we met our partners. Now it's like you go on an online dating app to find someone. How can you interact and engage online? It's really, and how do you learn those skills? If you've never been in a situation like we have in the past where we've had to do that, you've never had that skill. And actually, now everything's moving online anyway. You're never going to have to create or learn that skill. It's a scary thought. It's a very, very scary thought.
Yeah, and I think that's why I don't want to sort of focus on this because there's so many other things that I want us to discuss. However, you know, I just think it's a major topic that, you know, we seem to forget to talk about, you know, and I think it's something that is so important. I just think that people need to turn to becoming social again. I think we've lost the ability, and children are suffering from the lack of social interaction. They go to school and some, you know, they see their friends at school, but, you know, and they may go out in the evenings, but there are so many children that don't. And I'm talking, you know, specifically from personal, you know, I know children that are struggling with social interaction and things. So all I'm saying to listeners and to parents out there, I think we have to take responsibility of, you know, of what we allow our children to sort of be involved with. Because I know I went to an event, Monica, and I know I'm deviating slightly, but I just wanted to sort of mention this. I went to an event in May, and one of the big areas, and as you know, I'm Greek, but there was a family at this event that had lost their son to cyberbullying, and he was a beautiful young lad, and I knew who it was, and it was just heartbreaking to know that somebody has lost their life through somebody else you know, their words and being nasty. And, you know, children can be the worst, you know, so hurtful. And I just think we all just need to start to learn how to, you know, to socialize more and stand up to, you know, this social lack of social interaction. That's one of my things. But anyway, let's move on to another area. But
can I just say on that point, I think it's, you're absolutely right that yes, we as parents or caregivers do have a responsibility to try and limit that kind of media use and try to encourage our young people to have more social interactions. But I think we also need to acknowledge that we're asking them to do something that actually isn't normal to them. It's normal to us because that's what we grew up doing, but they've grown up in a world where that isn't normal. So if your young person doesn't respond positively to that, you know, encouragement, it isn't necessarily because, you know, they're being deviant or, you know, they're being disrespectful to what your request might be. Or actually, it's very difficult to do something that's out of the norm. So if it's not normal to you as a youngster or as an adult, you're going to find that hard. So I think you need to try and balance it in a way that we understand that, you know, yes, this is important, but it's also something that our young people aren't used to doing because it's not the normal way of doing things nowadays.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, I never thought of it from that perspective, but yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why you're the expert on this, Monica. I mean, what would you say, what are some of the effective strategies for maintaining good mental health, Monica?
So at Kaleidoscope, we work on the five ways to well-being. Research has shown that if you participate in any of these things, or five of these things, even better, you are more likely to maintain good mental health. So the five things are being active, so physical activity, having social connections, making sure that, you know, you have a good social network around you, perhaps learning something new, getting involved in different hobbies or learning a completely new skill. Giving is one, so like giving of your time, actually giving your time, perhaps volunteering, releases feel-good endorphins, makes you feel good as well, gives you a personal boost. But also taking notice, so things like mindfulness, noticing things around you, and taking that time to really look and feel and use your senses in terms of the environment and where you might be or what you might be doing at a particular point in time. So I think it's really important that, you know, we all try to get involved in some form of those things. So like I say, social interactions, building up support networks with trusted friends like you and I have and continue to do. I think it's really important that we do that. But also find ways that we can express and manage our emotions in a positive way. I personally find journaling a really good way of doing that, you know, writing things down, keeping a diary. And I know lots of people think I found that a good way of expressing their feelings. There may be things that you don't want to talk about or you don't really need to talk about, but you just want to kind of keep a note of it. And journaling also helps you look back on things, so you can, it helps you kind of see the journey you've come on. So, you know, you might be thinking that I'm having an awful day today. You might flip back to 3 months ago where you felt like you were having the worst day ever. So if you got through it then, actually, what's to say that you can't get through it now? And things like art and music are really good as well to help with maintaining good mental health. But it depends on what works for you, what works for, you know, I like journaling. Other people might not like journaling. They might like to do some sort of physical activity. I can't stand physical activity myself, but, you know, for others that really works. It all on what's right for you. Personally, I think having good social network is probably the most important one, because as we said earlier, it's really important to talk about your feelings and being able to share and express what you might be going through. So having a good network of people, and it might not be people, it might just be one person, having someone that you can trust and someone you can turn to, just to maybe sound things off, or, you know, signpost you or give you some advice. I think, you know, that's vital.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're so right there. One of the other statistics that we looked at, Monica, and you were talking about mental and physical, you know, they're combined. And I think one of the statistics I managed to sort of dig up was that regular physical activity actually reduces the risk of depression by up to 30%. And I don't, you know, again, it's staggering. I never, you know, these are things that people don't think about. But depression, you know, can set in very, very quickly for people. And by just doing something and getting out into nature and, you know, or going to the gym or just going for a walk and some fresh air can actually make a big difference to your mental to your mental well-being. So I just thought I'd add that statistic in there. But do you find that a lot of people that do have physical activity, is it something that you sort of promote?
Absolutely. As I say, it's one of the five ways to well-being. It releases endorphins in a person's brain, which is the natural mood booster. It's a feel-good factor. So if you are carrying out some sort of physical activity naturally, without you really having to do anything other than that particular physical activity, your brain will release chemicals that will make you feel good. So clearly it's good for you in terms of reducing anxiety, stress and depression, because it does promote those feelings of pleasure and overall well-being. But also, if you think about it, when you engage in a physical activity, it can increase your self-esteem, because if you're like me and do physical activity reluctantly, let me say, reluctantly, in order to kind of improve, I don't know, maybe I want to lose weight, or, you know, I'm going on holiday and, you know, I want to look my best. When you see those differences in your own body, actually that increases your self-esteem as well. So engaging in kind of exercise, it increases your self-esteem. It's by you seeing improvements in your fitness levels, in your strength and in your physical appearance, that naturally boosts your confidence as well. But then if you're participating, I guess, in a team physical activity, so let's say you're playing football, you've got your physical activity, which is good for you, but you've also got your social connections, which is another way of increasing your well-being. So you bring the two things together, actually you've got a double whammy there. You're doing two things without really realising it, which is improving your overall mental well-being as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting. Very, very, very interesting. So, I mean, talking about help, because obviously we're talking about, you know, people seeking help and trying to build their support systems, etc. I mean, what are some of the signs that would indicate someone is actually struggling with their mental health, Monica? And how can we as individuals help support them?
Again, I think it's important to say that it will be different things for different people. But generally, the things to look out for are things like changes in behaviour. So if somebody who is quite sociable, for example, starts to become a little bit socially withdrawn, or starts to avoid activities that perhaps they used to enjoy, maybe they start to show signs of like declined performance at work or school, those are things to look out for. Maybe they might start showing signs of perhaps mood swings, or have feelings of sadness, or they may start talking in a very negative way about themselves. But again, that can be an indication that perhaps emotionally they're not in a good place. You can find that perhaps people will have a different relationship with food. They might start gaining weight, or they might start losing weight. There may be changes to their eating patterns. There may be a loss of appetite. Again, that's an indication. A general lack of motivation in doing things, lethargy, perhaps feeling fatigued quite a lot. Again, that could be something that indicates that there may be an issue. They might start experiencing physical symptoms that maybe they didn't have before, so maybe more frequent headaches or digestion problems, different aches and pains. Well, you might find that they start indulging in destructive behaviour, so things like substance abuse or self-harm. Again, I have to stress that these are a kind of typical signs, but it doesn't mean that everybody is going to experience all of them. It's just about being aware that these can be indications. It could be an indication of something completely different, but they can be an indication that perhaps the person is going through a difficult time emotionally. I think in terms of what do you do once you've noticed it, obviously you need to be alert to these kind of things. You need to know the individual and what is normal for that individual. But it's about creating a non-judgmental environment for that person to have that conversation. Be approachable, be empathetic, and even if you don't understand where that individual's coming from, please, please, please validate their feelings. One of the things that we always say is that if somebody's feeling suicidal, for example, it's natural, it's human nature for you to kind of almost automatically say, oh, don't be silly, you don't want to do anything like that.
Yeah.
But actually, what you are then doing by saying that is you're not validating their feelings. For them, it's a very real feeling. For them, unfortunately, they do feel like actually there is no other way out. That is the only way out for them. So however hard it might be, it's really important to say, okay, I understand. Let's talk about this. That can be a really difficult conversation, really, really difficult conversation, because naturally you want to be saying, oh my goodness, please don't do that. I really don't want you to do that. I don't want you to think like that. But what we have to try and do is turn the conversation around and give them what we say, permission. Give them permission to talk about how they are feeling, because that is really, really important to validate that this is real for you. I might not understand it, but I get that this is real for you, and I accept that this is real for you. So let's try and talk about how we can get through this together. So showing understanding is really important, being empathetic, being compassionate. They're all really, really important things. But what I'd also say, Sophia, is we aren't necessarily professionals all of the time in terms of we can't provide professional support. So please don't feel like you have to take that responsibility if someone is displaying signs of distress or is presenting as perhaps being suicidal, because we can't take that responsibility on ourselves. What we can do is we need to get them and encourage them to seek professional support and support them through that process, whether that be taking them to the appointment, whether that be making the call for them. Self-care is really, really important. Self-care, you know, we can't take the responsibility ourselves of looking after that individual. We can't provide the intervention ourselves. We have to make sure that professional individuals provide the interventions on our behalf.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there's been, I think we've had this discussion before, Monica, but, you know, there's certainly been times, you know, with me personally where I've actually had friends who have felt, you know, that they've wanted to take their own lives, and there's been a situation where, you know, all I've done is be there to listen, you know, to let them talk about, you know, what was a major problem for them. And I normally use the word issue, but for them it was major issues and problems that, you know, they just felt that they couldn't overcome. And so I talk from first hand. I'm no counsellor, of course. Like, you know, I don't know the ins and outs, but we managed to, you know, they managed to actually get to speak to professional, you know, counsellors to be able to overcome that. And now, I've had, you know, messages come through to say thank you for just listening. You know, you don't know what you did for me, Sophia. And that to me, my God, it's just the biggest thank you that anybody could ever give me, just to feel grateful for being able to help somebody. I mean, there's nothing better than to know that you're able to help and support. And this is why I keep on saying, Monica, sometimes that a little bit of kindness and a little bit of understanding and actually just being, you know, an ear for somebody, being able to listen to what somebody's got to say, can actually be a massive turnaround for somebody. And I think sometimes we live such busy lives, Monica, that we don't take notice. So, you know, when you were talking about the symptoms potentially of people and noticing these things, sometimes we live in such busy lives, even, you know, our own partners or a family don't get to see that change in an individual, because some of them can actually hide it. They put on a face and you don't know what's going on behind the mask, in essence. So I think, like you said, it's really important to make sure that if you do pick up on that, that you do try and help, you know, that individual by sitting down and talking and listening to them and trying to direct them and put into the right direction, really, into the right hands. But
and sometimes that's all they need. Sometimes all they need is a shoulder to cry on or somebody to listen to them and offload. And once they've offloaded, actually, they often feel a lot better. It may not lead to them requiring actual professional help. It might just be that I need to have a chat with somebody because this is the way I'm feeling. They've offloaded, you know, the person they're speaking to has been empathetic, they've been compassionate, you know, they've actively listened and validated how they're feeling. And that's all they've needed, and it's fine.
Yeah.
And that's why social networks are so, so important. And for those people who may not have a social network, there are support groups out there that can do exactly the same thing, or there are text lines like ours or helplines.
Absolutely. And do you know what, Monica? I hope you and I, genuinely, and, you know, I hope you and I can bring some love and light to this issue really worldwide, because I think, you know, there is help. You don't have to go through this alone. There are people out there who are there for you and will be there for you. You just have to be believe that, you know, that you can get through this. Because at the end of the day, like you said, Monica, you know, when somebody is struggling with their mental health, nothing somebody will say, you know, could change their mind. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, just listen. Listen, be kind, talk, you know, be their rock to be able to help them and support them. Because I'm hoping that we can actually do that. And one of the things I wanted to say is that if there is anybody out there that doesn't want to call in but wants us to reach out, please send us a message. And Monica and I would be delighted to, you know, to come back to you if you, you know, obviously to talk to you and you know, message you and see what we can do and answer any questions that you may have. So yeah, I'm literally going
can
to
I just
go
throw in
into,
a, sorry
go ahead, Monica.
I was gonna say I'd like to throw in another statistic if you don't mind, because
please do.
I think again it's important for listeners to know that actually statistically, you are more likely to come across somebody who's experiencing suicidal thoughts than somebody who is about to have a heart attack.
Wow.
Not many people
wow.
would believe that statistic, but that is a global statistic.
Oh, my God.
So it shows how important talking about this subject is.
Wow. Monica, on that note, we are going to take another quick break. And we will thank you, everybody, for listening. Stay, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
again. Welcome back. You're listening to Sophia on the Ask Sophia Show. Again, I have Monica Shafak, the CEO of Kaleidoscope Charity, and we're here talking about mental health and how important it is to know what we're facing and what we're looking at. So again, welcome back, Monica, and thank you so far for a fabulous conversation that we're having so far. And I've been looking at some of the statistics again, Monica, and I was looking for the American side of things. A recent survey that was done, 56% of American adults with mental illness apparently did not receive treatment. What does that equate to for the UK? If you don't, do you have any sort of statistics on that basis, Monica? Do we have anything to give us an idea?
So roughly 78% of people who suffer with mental health illness don't seek support for that condition. If you break it down between men and women, men are 8 times more likely than women not to seek support. And again, that's usually to do with things like the expectations that perhaps society place on men to, we use words, don't we, like man up or just get on with it, you know, big men don't cry, those kind of things. That reinforces the stigma that's associated with mental illness, and that creates those further barriers for men. So when you break it down further, as I say, there are more men who don't seek support, but overall the statistic is around 78.
Well, and I think the difference between the American, and we're very, very fortunate here in the UK as well. Obviously, we have charities such as yourselves that obviously are there to help support. And also we have the NHS that can, can help us from that perspective. But in America, I understand, you know, the statistics come from the lack of funding. You know, a lot of people just don't have the funding to be able to get the services and support that they actually need. You know, they don't have, as what we would call it in America, social medicine in that case. They have to pay for their own healthcare, which is very different for us. We're very fortunate. You know, we're one of the countries where we do actually get the NHS. So, you know, thank you goes out to all of our NHS, people. And I think we should think ourselves quite lucky. But I just thought I needed to sort of explain that, because I know that, you know, in America specifically, and I, from speaking to a lot of connections and individuals in the States, it's such an expensive game to get any treatment, whether it be for mental health or any medical issue. You know, most of the world has social medicine, as we would call it, but the USA, everybody has to have their insurance to cover that. So yeah, I think it's very important to make everybody aware that the statistics obviously vary in many ways because of the lack of funding, I think, as well. But so, I mean, moving on, I mean, let's have a look at some of the other areas. I mean, we were talking and we touched on mental health, Monica, you know, across different age groups, such as children, adolescents, and, you know, and adults. How does it differ? You know, so how does mental health differ across those different age groups? What is the difference? What do you find, you know, is the difference between, you know, adults, children, adolescents? You know, how does that differ?
Again, generally speaking, there are going to be different issues and different prevalences against different age groups. So if you think about children from the ages of 0 to 12, they're going through rapid physical development, cognitive development, and their mental health is closely tied, I guess, with developmental milestones and the environment around them. So if they have a nurturing environment around them, the chances are that they will have better mental health than those who maybe don't have a nurturing environment around them, those are your kind of developmental years. So there's a strong correlation between that and your mental health at that stage. So having a supportive family environment and access to the right kind of education and interventions that are tailored to that age group plays a vital role to promote positive mental health. But then if you move on to kind of the adolescence years, we talked earlier about the challenges around social media and, you know, the lack of social interaction that individuals of that age group are currently experiencing. This is a period of intense growth and self-discovery for young people of that age, and it can be really difficult for them to navigate the kind of physical and the emotional changes that they're forming, both in, you know, physically and with their identity. So I think again, it's about creating really safe spaces for open discussions and fostering supportive relationships with caregivers and family members, but ensuring also that they have access to things like counselling, because you will find that people within that age group do need counselling. And it, again, speaking in the UK specifically, over 80% of mental health conditions actually start from around about the age of 14. So this is a crucial part of somebody's life in terms mm-hmm. of how their mental health will develop. And then obviously as you get older, you know, there are other challenges that life presents yourself with. So let's take adults from the age of, let's say, 18 to 64. You know, there will be life challenges that include things in their careers, in their relationships, perhaps parenthood, financial responsibilities, personal growth. All of these things, Sophia, as you know, they bring challenges with them. So again, that's going to influence their mental health as well. So societal pressures, I think, probably play the largest part for that particular age group. And then when you move into older adulthood, physical conditions, perhaps retirement, because when you retire, you can lose that kind of sense of purpose, which is strongly yeah. linked to having a good mental health. You may sadly lose loved ones. There can be physical health changes. You have to adjust to different societal roles. So, you know, like I say, if you lose a loved one, you adjust your role within life. If you've retired, you adjust your role within life. And all of these things can be triggers that impact you on your mental health. So it varies between the age spectrums. But like I say, if you break it down kind of generally, those are kind of the categories that I'd put it in.
Okay. Yeah, really, really interesting. So, I mean, I'm thinking about, we touched on very, very lightly earlier, but I'd like to go back to that. In the workplace, Monica, you know, a lot of mental health and mental stress, for example, is a big factor to obviously mental health. So from an employer's perspective, how can employers create a mentally healthy work environment and support their employees?
I think every employer needs to take an active responsibility to cultivate a culture that values mental health and well-being, and a culture that promotes open communication and respect and empathy of this subject. We spend so much time at work, we probably spend more time at work than we do socially or with our loved ones, that it's really important that we are happy in our places of work. Research yeah. has actually shown, more so since the pandemic, that employers' ability to protect the mental health and well-being of employees actually the number one thing that people are looking for nowadays, because of the fact that we recognise that life's too short, we spend a lot of time at work, so it's got to be an environment where this issue isn't something that's skirted over. This issue is high on the agenda, that there's a culture where you can talk about your mental health, where you can speak to your manager in an open and non-judgmental way, where you don't feel like if there is a mental health illness occurring that you will be discriminated against or you will be seen as somebody who is not able to do their job properly. With that also comes the need for employers, I guess, to ensure that their managers are trained effectively in this area, that they're trained to recognise, to see the signs of mental health issues, and that they're trained to create those supportive conversations that are vital. So they need to equip their staff to be able to deal with these issues, but they also need to be able to create the cultures where people are quite happy to talk about this issue openly. I think in terms of resources, there's a lot of things that employers can do. I know over here in the UK, we tend to use employee assistance programs quite openly. I think that's an avenue that all employers globally should consider if that's not something that they're doing. This gives the employee a route, an avenue, I guess, for them to seek support outside of the workplace, but facilitated by their employers, where they can perhaps receive counselling, or they can be signposted to some other kind of support networks. But it's also about encouraging great work-life balance. You know, I said to you, we spend so much time at work, and we put a lot of pressure on ourselves, not always the employers. We put a lot of pressure on ourselves to work a certain amount of hours, but actually we have to create boundaries. Employers have to create boundaries where we are taking breaks, where we're taking our annual leave, where we are practicing self-care. Because with all of that, if you nurture that kind of environment, if you create that kind of culture, actually your employees are going to be a lot more productive. You'll get a lot more out of them. It will reduce absenteeism. It will reduce sickness levels. It will increase productivity. So it's a win-win situation for everybody. And I think sometimes I certainly find that when I'm talking about this subject with senior individual organizations, I have to bring the productivity into it, because they don't necessarily bring they don't necessarily make the connection, which is quite a sad thing to do, because you think ethically as an employee you should be thinking about how do I create that kind of environment for my workforce, because I respect them and people are our biggest asset at the end of the day, as an employer. So, you know, we sometimes have to find different ways of trying to get them to understand how important this issue is. And actually at Kaleidoscope, we've developed a program called Wellbeing in the Workplace, which is a training program. It's a consultation program. It's a program where we can come in and we can look at strategies that the individual organizations adopt, and we can help create that kind of culture, and we can put the strategies in place for you so you can achieve all of these things. And we've been delivering that online, and we've been delivering it face-to-face as well. So, you know, there are organizations like ours that you can reach out to if you don't actually know where to start, because this is a vitally important thing as an employer to be able to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just, you know, another statistic that, you know, mental health conditions, you know, they do account for approximately 30%, I have here, of all disability claims in the workplace. So exactly what you've just said, you know, it's very important that we take note. And I mean, when we're looking at the future of mental health, Monica, how do you envision the future of mental health care and support?
What I would personally like to see is I would like to see a society that accepts that mental illness is something that is quite common. It's something that we shouldn't be ashamed about. It's something that we shouldn't associate a stigma with. It's a condition that we are quite happily and readily able to go and seek support for, in the same way that we would seek support for our physical health. I'd like to see a future where children and young people talk about their emotional health in the same way as they may talk about anything else, so it becomes a normal conversation, so that over time, you know, it is just... talking about your mental health is just a normal thing to do. Talking about feelings of suicide is a normal thing to do. I'd also like to see a future where the kind of services that are offered are readily available to wider communities, to more communities, in different accessible ways. I keep saying not one size fits all, because it doesn't. What will work for me may not work for you. What might work for you might not work for the next person. We have to provide person-centered holistic support services that work in conjunction with other services as well, because people who present with a mental health condition will also have other support needs. They will have physical support needs. They may have support needs around employment. They may need support needs around financial and debt advice, around relationships. A whole host of things are associated with mental illness.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important for organisations in the voluntary sector and in the statutory sector and government agencies to work collaboratively, because I will say again, all have mental health. It's something that affects everybody. It is the one illness
that does not
discriminate. I don't care
Absolutely.
Who you are. I don't care how old you are, what background you come from, what ethnicity you are, whether you're work, whether you're unemployed, whether you're male, female, or, you know, indifferent. You all have mental health. So this is something everybody needs to work on collectively. And as a society, we also need to come together to create those environments where, as I said earlier, we can have those open, compassionate, kind conversations. So for me, that is what I would like to see the future looking like.
Okay. So how do you, following on from that, so how can society, you know, all of us as a whole, work towards prioritising mental health and well-being, in your opinion?
I think there needs to be a lot more education. I think we need to start educating people at a very young age, or at least a younger age than we do at the moment. As I said earlier, talking about mental health and emotional well-being should be part of the curriculum, certainly here in the UK. We should be talking about these things early on, so that it normalises those conversations. I think we need to encourage workplace training, make that, in the UK, you have to have a physical first aider. So if somebody, as I said earlier, if they had a heart attack, you need to have somebody on site who knows how to deal with that. They need to be trained in physical first aid. We advocate that actually you should have a mental first aider in your organisation as well, because as I said earlier, the chances are you will come across somebody who is experiencing poor mental health more so than somebody who's experiencing poor physical health. So I think we need to advocate for that as a society. We need to promote the integration of mental health services so that all of those services that I mentioned earlier are working more collaboratively and we are providing more of a holistic and comprehensive care and support to individuals. And I think there needs to be early intervention as well. And by early intervention, I mean noticing the signs that we talked about earlier so that people don't actually get into a situation where they're at crisis point before they seek support. So creating those environments where we can have that open conversation, where we have those compassionate conversations. And it might just be sending someone a text and saying, hey, how you doing? I haven't spoken to you for a while. Or calling them, just checking in, a regular check-in. We said earlier, didn't we, Sophia, about how important it is to be that listening ear, making that part and parcel of our everyday lives, just checking in on people. It means a lot to individuals. So I think collectively there's a lot of things that we can do. One of the other things I think is that we need to stand up and be counted. If we are hearing people talking about mental health in a way that is stigmatizing or in a way that is discriminatory, we need to stand up and be counted and say, hey, we shouldn't be talking like that. We shouldn't be speaking like that. Challenge those perceptions and challenge that narrative, because the more we challenge, the more we stand up for things like that, the more people will become aware of how to approach things, but also they'll become aware of the right way of doing things as opposed to kind of building on that stigma.
I couldn't agree more. I absolutely 100% agree with you on that. And I think that's where we are not doing as much as we could, where we don't challenge. So if we do hear it, like you say, we should be challenging that. So very good point. A very good point. On that note as well, I looked at like I said, I love statistics and I like looking at different things. But one of the statistics that we sort of uncovered as well from a global perspective, Monica, the global economic burden of mental health, I nearly died when I read this, of mental health conditions is expected to exceed $16 trillion by 2030. And that's only, what, 7 years away? $16 trillion. It's just shocking. I don't think people actually realize what a major issue that mental health is. And I'm hoping that this sheds a light for, you know, millions of people. And I know we have over 7 million listeners this evening, which is, you know, which is phenomenal all over the world. And I'm hoping that, you know, people can take something from this. But I wanted to sort of shed a light as well for you and give you the opportunity, Monica, because we are working together on a very important ball, are we not? And I,
we are indeed.
To discuss that. it is the 50th anniversary of the Kaleidoscope charity, obviously, and we have got the charity ball, which I have been mentioning, by the way, every week on this show, on the 7th of October this year at the Belfry in Warwickshire, which is a renowned location where the Ryder Cup has been played on several occasions. Do you want to give the listeners a little bit of an idea of what's going on with the ball?
Yeah, so as you said, it's our 50th anniversary. So this is an annual event that takes place, or it did take place every year until the COVID pandemic hit. But this year, given that it's our 50th anniversary, it is going to be bigger and better, and we are going to showcase the fantastic work that my team do at Kaleidoscope. We're going to showcase the impact that our charity makes, but we're also going to use the opportunity as a fundraising event, because as Sophia said earlier, we do heavily rely on donations and sponsorship, because we don't get that funding from the government in the same way that perhaps years ago charities used to receive funding. And demand for our services have skyrocketed. And it's really important that we can continue to deliver our services, because for some people, Kaleidoscope is all that they have. They don't have any connection with anybody else. So this is a huge event for us. There will be entertainment. It will be a black tie event. There will be fantastic food and lots of other things that I'm not going to mention, because I'm going to keep it a surprise for those of you that are attending. But Sophia's been working with me on this, and you know, anything that Sophia does is always fantastic. So this is just going to be spectacular.
Well, I just need to put a shout out there as well. And if you don't mind me mentioning, I just want to say that I love Greg Lassiter. He has sponsored the ball, obviously. So Greg Holdings have sponsored the ball, which is a phenomenal, achievement for us. We know that obviously the funds that you're going to be raising are absolutely going to be going, you know, into helping people, you know, with their mental health. So, Mr. Lassiter, I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart, because it's my charity of choice as well. So the TNOCI and obviously Grex Jets and Grex Holdings are going to be helping Monica to sponsor this event. So we are going to raise a lot of money, Monica. We are going to try and raise, you know, as much as we possibly can, which is brilliant. So, yeah.
Can I also say a personal thank you to Greg for sponsoring the ball? Because without sponsorship of this nature, actually, we wouldn't be able to do what we're doing. So the impact, Greg, that you are making through your sponsorship is literally going to save lives. Literally, there are people that whose lives have been saved and will be saved because of people like you sponsoring and donating to our cause. I cannot thank you enough. Thank you so much.
He actually say, you are welcome, Monica. He can't speak at this moment, but he's saying you are welcome. But listen, we are going to have an amazing night. The ball is actually nearly sold out now. And if anybody wants to travel to the UK, if you're from anywhere in the world, you're welcome to come. You can actually go to the Kaleidoscope website. Monica, do you want to just give your website details out, if that's okay? I can put it on online as well, so it's not a problem. But if you want to say it out loud, then you're welcome to do so.
Absolutely. So it's www.kaleidoscopeplus.org.uk.
Perfect. So if anybody wants to book any tickets, please, please, please go to the website and book your tickets. It's going to be an amazing night. You'll get to meet myself, you'll get to meet Greg, and you'll also get to meet Monica and an array of amazing people that are there helping, supporting the charity. So, yeah, I also just want to say a huge thank you again, like I said, to everybody that's actually booked their places to the ball. Already, like I said, I think we've only got about 30 spaces left, Monica, so it's not too bad. It's done really, really well. But on that note, I also want to promote the fact that for those of you who listen into the show weekly, you are probably aware that, again, Mr. Greg Lassiter and myself have written a children's book, which is Emma's European Adventure, which is on pre-sale at the moment, so you can actually order your copy of Emma's European Adventure at www.emmasfabulousadventures.com. Now, we will be donating a percentage of all the profits from the books to two charities, one being Kaleidoscope and also a charity in the US, which Greg is in the process of dealing with at this moment in time, which covers and deals with illiteracy. So we definitely want to make sure that we give back. So everybody, please order the book so that we can actually give back as much as we possibly can. But I also want to cover that we are going to be launching, and don't forget to tune in to our new show, the Greg and Sophia Vibe, which is going to launch Thursday the 13th of July from 7 time, and it is going to be fun. And of course, next Saturday you've got the Ask Sophia show again at the new time of 4:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So please, please, please tune in. But with reference to the ball again, Monica, I think we've got quite a few companies that are supporting the ball, and we also have quite a lot of individuals that are coming to the ball, if I am correct. And there's going to be a lot of friends and family as well that are going to be able to celebrate with us, and we're going to have a good time, aren't we? So we just
we're
going to
have a fabulous time.
I'm actually so excited. Now, I'm just going to take a very, very quick break again, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes, and we'll carry on with our discussions.
We'll be right back.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back again to Sophia here with the Ask Sophia Show on G Radio New York City. I just want to conclude, and I just would like to thank all of you for listening, but especially to my special guest, Monica. Thank you so much for taking the time out to actually come on the show and enlighten us about mental health. So a huge thank you from all of us here at the Ask Sophia Show. We hope that today the discussions that we have actually shed some light on and the importance of mental health has helped to reduce the stigma and provided valuable insights and resources for you and all of you out there, you know, listening today. So remember, taking care of our mental health is a collective responsibility, and together we can create a world where mental well-being is prioritized and it's definitely supported. So again, Monica, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and thank you so much for shining a light on this really important subject.
Bless you. God bless you. And let's see what we can do. So until next time, take care, everybody, and be kind to your mind. So goodbye for now, and have a great day.
If you believe you can move the highest mountains, cross the greatest oceans, walk across the water, the water. You feel defeated, falling on your knees and looking up for some hope tonight. You try to stand up, but you throw your hands up, like you no longer have the strength to fight. Cause you've seen too many sunsets, too many days ending in the darkest night. But on your own, you'll never know if you believe. All you need is faith, but it's almost like you lost your way. Took a few wrong turns, took a few breaks, falling behind now looking for grace. Cause you need someone to lift you up, yeah, make right of the things you've done. Cause on your own you'll never know if you believe you can move the highest mountain, cross the greatest ocean, walk across the
ready for an enchanting adventure that will ignite your child's imagination. Introducing Emma's European Adventure, a captivating children's book filled with interactive fun. Join Emma as she embarks on a thrilling journey through the heart of Europe. From the dazzling streets of Paris to the ancient ruins of Rome, your child will be immersed in a world of wonder and discovery. With engaging activities, interactive and vibrant illustrations, Emma's European Adventure will bring the story to life like never before. Your child will laugh, learn, and be inspired every step of the way. Pre-order your copy now for just $24.99. visit www.emmasfabulousadventures.com to secure your spot in this unforgettable tale. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity to spark your child's imagination and create cherished memories together.